Today is Saturday, August 9th, and you're listening to the World Socialist Website. Trump orders federal police mobilization in Washington, D.C. by Patrick Martin. In another step toward the establishment of an authoritarian regime in America, with a dictator president ruling through the police and military, President Donald Trump has ordered the mobilization of federal police from multiple agencies to patrol the streets of the U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C. Federal officers have been drawn from 15 federal agencies, including the U.S. Secret Service, the Department of Homeland Security, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the FBI, the U.S. Capitol Police, the Federal Protective Service, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the U.S. Park Police, the U.S. Marshals Service, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia, and the police forces of Amtrak Passenger Rail Service, and the Washington Metro. At least 120 federal agents were on the streets Friday night, supplementing the 3,400 officers of the Metropolitan Police Department. But a far larger number may be mobilized over the course of the week-long exercise, which could be extended, quote-unquote, as needed, according to White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt. Trump is threatening an even greater show of force in the U.S. Capitol, including a direct federal takeover of the local District of Columbia government, and the deployment of the National Guard. Posting on Truth Social Tuesday, Trump wrote, quote, "If D.C. doesn't get its act together and quickly, we will have no choice but to take federal control of the city and run the city how it should be run and put criminals on notice that they're not going to get away with it anymore," end quote. At a press briefing Wednesday, Trump repeated the threat, saying, quote, "We have to run D.C., end quote, adding, quote, "That includes bringing in the National Guard, maybe very quickly too," end quote. Asked about seeking congressional repeal of home rule, the limited self-government in the federal district established in 1973, Trump replied, quote, "The lawyers are already studying it," end quote. As that comment indicates, the effort to take control of the U.S. Capitol by force has been under consideration for some time. Trump actually proposed taking such action in 2020 during the nationwide mass protests over the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Units of the National Guard were called up, but kept outside the district because the Pentagon High Command viewed the deployment as poorly prepared and premature. There will be no such opposition in 2025. As a pretext for his latest effort to flood the district with police and troops, Trump cited the attempted carjacking Sunday of a former staff member of the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, the budget-cutting task force once headed by billionaire Elon Musk. Two 15-year-olds have been arrested and charged as juveniles for the alleged attack on Edward Korestein in DuPont Circle, but Trump called for the District of Columbia to change its laws to allow youth to be prosecuted as adults. Quote, "This is the first step in stopping the violent crime that has been plaguing the streets of Washington, D.C., end quote, Leavitt said in a statement Friday. However, FBI figures show a sharp decline in both violent and property crimes in the district. For the past 5 years, despite the poverty and desperation in the poorest sections of the city. The most deranged and blood-curdling statement came, predictably, from White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, Trump's most openly fascistic aide, who claimed Thursday that Washington, D.C., quote, "is more violent than Baghdad, it is more violent than parts of Ethiopia, and parts of many of the most dangerous places in the world," end quote. The clear implication is that Washington, like Baghdad, should be the target of U.S. military violence on a massive scale. Trump's provocation in Washington, D.C. must be seen in the context of repeated efforts to normalize police-military repression at home and to accustom the American population to the sight of tanks and troops in their streets. In one of his first executive orders, Trump ordered thousands of Marines to be deployed to the U.S.-Mexico border, and on Friday, it was reported that U.S. military forces have been authorized to engage in combat operations against so-called cartels which operate in the border region. Even more ominous actions include the deployment of Marines and National Guard troops into Los Angeles in early June on the pretext of violence deliberately provoked by ICE roundups of immigrant workers and mobilization of tanks, helicopters, warplanes, and thousands of soldiers for a military parade in Washington on Trump's birthday, June 14th. Large-scale ICE raids are targeting cities like New York and Chicago, aiming to provoke violence and set the stage for further military intervention. In the U.S. Capitol, Trump has the power to call up and deploy the D.C. National Guard without the consent of the mayor, Democrat Muriel Bowser. And, under the 1973 Home Rule Act, he can take over the D.C. Police Department in, quote-unquote, special conditions of an emergency, as the president may deem necessary and appropriate. Trump has invoked such emergency powers in virtually every sphere of his presidency, including tariffs, attacks on immigrants, and the crackdown on opposition by students and youth to the U.S.-backed Israeli genocide in Gaza. There is a glaring contradiction in Trump's law and order demagogy, particularly as it relates to Washington, D.C. By far the largest outbreak of violence in Washington, or in any American city, in recent years, was the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, by thousands of fascistic Trump supporters invited to Washington by Trump and urged to march on the Capitol and, quote-unquote, fight to keep him in the White House. Five people died, and more than 130 Capitol police were injured in the onslaught. Since returning to the White House, Trump has pardoned all the January 6 criminals while purging the Department of Justice of the FBI agents who investigated the coup attempt and the lawyers who prosecuted the fascist thugs. This history is studiously avoided in the media coverage of Trump's campaign in support of police-military violence. Trump's threat to use military force in the streets of the U.S. Capitol must be taken with the utmost seriousness. This is a government at war with the working class at home and abroad, seeking to defend the class rule of the billionaire oligarchs who control both capitalist parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. This war is being waged from a position of desperate weakness and crisis. Trump has already faced the largest mass demonstrations in American history, culminating in the June 14th No Kings protest, in which more than 10 million people took part. His policies are deeply unpopular, and his approval rating in the polls has plunged below 40%. Only the spinelessness of the Democratic Party and the collaboration of the trade unions allow Trump to proceed as though he were the undisputed ruler of the entire U.S. population and even the world. It is up to the working class, potentially the most powerful force in society, to prepare the necessary social and political response to the crisis of capitalism and the danger of dictatorship and imperialist war. This means building a mass political movement of working people based on a socialist program. Israel formally adopts plan to occupy all of Gaza. by Andre Damon. Israel's National Security Cabinet approved a plan Friday to take over Gaza City, effectively occupying the entirety of Gaza in preparation for its annexation by Israel. Quote, "We are erasing the Palestinian state," end quote, said Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich on Friday in response to the decision. Quote, "First in action and then officially," end quote. The cabinet approved a series of war goals, including ensuring that neither Hamas nor the Palestinian Authority would govern Gaza. The plan declared the, quote, "establishment of an alternative civil administration," end quote. On Thursday, Netanyahu was asked in favor on Fox News whether Israel would take over all of Gaza. Quote, "We intend to," end quote, he replied. Commenting on the significance of the move, the Financial Times wrote that the measure, quote, "paves the way for Israel to take over the Palestinian enclave for the second time since the 1967 war, leaving the nation in effective control of all the territories between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea," end quote. The total occupation of Gaza is the military prerequisite for the U.S.-Israeli plan to transfer the entire population of Gaza to concentration camps in preparation for their forcible displacement to other countries. In February, Trump declared, quote, "the U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip," end quote, quote, "level it out," end quote, and disperse the Palestinian population of Gaza to, quote-unquote, other countries. In May, Israeli Finance Minister Smotrich declared, quote, "within a year, Gaza will be entirely destroyed. Civilians will be sent to the south, to a humanitarian zone, and from there they will start to leave in great numbers to third countries," end quote. On Friday, Trump said that the U.S. is, quote-unquote, "working on a proposal to remove the Palestinian people to Somaliland." Trump was asked by a reporter, quote, "you spoke of resettling the Gazans. The country of Somaliland has expressed potential interests if you were to recognize their independence," end quote. Trump replied, quote, "we're looking into that right now. We're working on that right now," end quote. Earlier this week, the Financial Times reported that consultants from the Boston Consulting Group, a major U.S. corporate consulting group, had worked on models for relocating the Palestinian people to Somalia and Somaliland in a proposal first raised by the Trump administration earlier this year. The FT reported, quote, "multiple potential destinations were listed in a complex spreadsheet created on behalf of Israeli business people who were sketching plans for the redevelopment of Gaza after the war between Hamas and Israel," end quote. Gaza City, in the enclave's north, currently contains approximately 1 million people, most of whom have already been displaced multiple times in the course of the 22-month war. Before the genocide, it already had a higher population density than New York City, and its population has only swelled as people fled there from other parts of the country. Gaza's approximately 2 million remaining residents have been forcibly displaced many times and are largely living in tents and destroyed buildings. According to statistics from Gaza's government health ministry, 61,000 people have been killed since the start of the genocide. U.S. Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the plan to occupy Gaza City, calling it, quote, "a dangerous escalation," end quote. He said it, quote, "will result in additional forced displacement, killings, and massive destruction, compounding the unimaginable suffering of the Palestinian population in Gaza," end quote. The occupation of the city was scheduled to be completed by October 7th. In a statement, Amnesty International Secretary General Agnes Callamard said the plan to occupy Gaza City was, quote, "utterly outrageous and revolting," end quote, adding, quote, "nothing can justify the additional mass atrocities that an expanded military operation in Gaza will entail, end quote. She concluded, quote, just as we thought we had already seen the cruelest, most painful chapters of this genocide unfold, through Israel's continued and escalating use of starvation as a method of warfare, plans to escalate the military operations in Gaza City indicate that indeed the worst is yet to come, end quote. Michael Link, a former UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the occupied Palestinian territory, told Al Jazeera, quote, you know and I know over the last 6 months, we've heard a constant refrain coming from both the United States and from Israel with respect to wanting to see the Palestinian population in Gaza either thinned out or perhaps removed altogether. All of that would be certainly a war crime, quite likely also a crime against humanity. And if it's part of a larger aim to try to destroy a people, in whole or in part, then it's also genocide, end quote. In a separate statement, UN Human Rights Chief Volker Türk said the occupation of Gaza City, quote, runs contrary to the ruling of the International Court of Justice that Israel must bring its occupation to an end as soon as possible, to the realization of the agreed two-state solution, and to the right of Palestinians to self-determination, end quote. In a statement published July 29th, the UN-backed Integrated Food Security Phase Classification warned, quote, the worst-case scenario of famine is currently playing out in the Gaza Strip, end quote. It added, quote, mounting evidence shows that widespread starvation, malnutrition, and disease are driving a rise in hunger-related deaths. Latest data indicates that famine thresholds have been reached for food consumption in most of the Gaza Strip and for acute malnutrition in Gaza City, end quote. Italian dock workers block Saudi ship carrying weapons for Israel, by Mark Wells. On August 7th, dock workers in Genoa mounted a determined blockade against the transit of the Saudi ship Bahri Yanbu in a direct challenge to Italy's role in arming Israel and its imperialist allies. The ship, arriving from Baltimore, Maryland, in the United States, was scheduled to load military equipment produced by the Italian arms conglomerate Leonardo, including an Otto Melara cannon bound for Abu Dhabi, and possibly tanks or other heavy weapons already staged in the terminal yard. Refusing to become accomplices in the Gaza genocide, the workers blocked the loading of the cannon and exposed the ship's cargo, already filled with weapons, ammunition, explosives, armored vehicles, and tanks, through on-site inspections at dawn. Despite attempts to obstruct their access, around 40 dock workers boarded to document the shipment. Their defiance forced the port authority into damage control mode, offering vague promises to discuss in September the creation of a, quote, permanent observatory on arms trafficking, end quote. The dock workers made their position clear, quote, we don't work for war, end quote. In 2019, workers blocked a similar shipment for the same Saudi company after discovering the declared civilian cargo was in fact weaponry. That mobilization extracted a pledge to stop loading such cargo, but no ban on transit was ever implemented, allowing the weapons flow to continue. This week's action immediately drew the intervention of the major union federations, CGIL, CISL, UIL, alongside Base Unions USB Unione Sindicale di Base and CALP, Collettivo Autonomo Lavatori Portuali. They were joined by pacifist groups and Genoese Church, whose involvement since 2021 has enjoyed the explicit support of Pope Francis. The Confederated Unions announced a ban on loading arms for war zones, quote-unquote, by any means. But their real role was to corral the protest inside the narrow confines of legality, invoking Italy's Law 185-90, which supposedly prohibits arms exports to countries engaged in conflict. USB, for its part, filed a formal complaint earlier and invoked the Constitution's repudiation of war in its quote-unquote Labor Rejects War manifesto. CALP leader Jose Nevoy stated plainly that handling such cargo would make workers complicit in war crimes and the genocide in Gaza. On August 8th, CALP and USB staged another protest at Ponte Ethiopia, disrupting traffic across the port area. The unions announced that mobilizations will continue, culminating in September with an international dock workers' assembly to coordinate opposition to turning Genoa into a logistics hub for war. The present blockade follows a significant episode in late July when Genoa dock workers blocked the unloading of military cargo bound for Israel after receiving intelligence from Greek unions PAME and ENEDEP. That shipment, military-grade steel, had already been intercepted in Piraeus by Greek port workers, then rerouted to Genoa aboard the Chinese vessel COSCO, shipping Pisces. USB responded with an immediate refusal to handle the cargo and a threat to strike, ultimately forcing the operators to return the containers to the Far East. These actions connect directly to earlier episodes of international solidarity. On October 20th, 2024, dock workers in Piraeus halted the loading of 21 tons of ammunition destined for Israel after Palestinian trade unions issued an urgent appeal for workers worldwide to refuse all roles in Israel's arms supply chain. Similar refusals have occurred in Barcelona, Belgian transport hubs, and the French port of Marseille, where CGT dockers blocked arms shipments in June. Such interventions demonstrate the enormous potential of targeted sector-wide labor action. The Mediterranean coordination between PAME, ENEDEP, USB, and French dockers proves that workers possess the means to strike directly at the logistical arteries of imperialist war. However, these actions remain under the stifling grip of the union bureaucracies. While PAME declares that workers, quote, will not become accomplices, end quote, to Israel and its allies, their perspective, like that of USB and Cicobas, remains trapped within the nationalist and legal framework of the capitalist state. They seek to, quote, politicize the strike, end quote, while preserving their role as defenders of the system rather than mobilizing the working class as an independent revolutionary force. The intervention of the Confederated Unions, the church, and various legal authorities in Genoa is aimed at preempting a broader struggle and keeping rank-and-file militancy within safe boundaries. By presenting the blockade as a question of legal compliance, whether with Law 185-90 or constitutional clauses, they channel workers' anger into appeals to the very capitalist state that organizes and profits from the arms trade. Leonardo, Italy's largest weapons manufacturer, continues to export to regimes across the globe with the approval of governments of every political stripe. Meloni's far-right coalition, like its predecessors, has no intention of halting the lucrative arms trade to Israel, Saudi Arabia, or the United Arab Emirates. Claims by Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani that all arms shipments to Israel have ceased are lies, exposed by the recent events. Rome's real policy is one of accelerating militarization and suppressing opposition. Last September, Parliament passed the so-called anti-Gandhi law, criminalizing road and rail blockades with prison sentences of up to 2 years. This followed a June security decree that extended police powers lengthened prison terms, and targeted protest tactics. These measures are aimed squarely at the working class to ensure that anti-war mobilizations like the Genoa blockade can be crushed under the guise of public order. Italy's place in the global war drive is central. As a NATO member and EU stalwart, it has committed to Washington's confrontations with Russia and China while maintaining close ties with Israel and Gulf monarchies. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni presents herself as a champion of quote-unquote national interest and quote-unquote pro-Western nationalism, aligning with Trump's demand for higher European military spending. Under the EU SAFE plan, her government is drawing 14 billion euros in low-cost loans to modernize Italy's armed forces, a windfall for defense industry giants like Leonardo and Fincantieri. This militarization is integrated into civilian life through the quote-unquote dual-use doctrine, which designates infrastructure like Genoa's port as both civilian and military. This blurring of lines forces dock workers into the position of handling war cargo as part of their normal duties under conditions of stagnant wages, worsening safety, and the ever-present risk of retaliation for resistance. The Genoa blockade is therefore not just an act of solidarity with Gaza, but a direct rejection of the militarized transformation of the Italian economy. Yet the greatest danger facing workers is the role of the union bureaucracy itself. Time and again, workers have demonstrated their willingness to act, blocking ships, refusing to load weapons, coordinating across borders. But under the leadership of CGIL, CISL, UIL, USB, CECOBAS, and similar bodies, this resistance is subordinated to appeals to the capitalist state and its laws. The union's strategy is to contain militancy, to prevent independent rank-and-file organization, and to keep actions episodic rather than as part of a revolutionary strategy. The international communications that enabled the July victory against the COSCO shipping Pisces show what is possible when workers act in concert across national borders. But for this potential to be realized, workers must free themselves from the grip of bureaucracies that ultimately defend the existing order. Genuine rank-and-file committees, democratically controlled by workers themselves, must be formed in every port, warehouse, and transport hub. The International Workers' Alliance of Rank-and-File Committees, IWA-RFC, is fighting to link up these struggles internationally, not only to share information, but to prepare coordinated action aimed at stopping the imperialist war machine at its source. The Genoa Dockers' stand resonates far beyond Italy's borders. It shows that the working class, the producers of all wealth, and strategically placed in the logistic chains of global capitalism, holds immense power to disrupt the plans of the ruling class. But power, unused, or only used within the limits set by the state and its loyal union apparatus, will be dissipated. The choice before workers is stark. Continue to rely on organizations committed to defending capitalism, or build an independent movement aimed at ending both the wars abroad and the social assault at home. The working class possesses the strength to halt the arms convoys, empty the warships, and dismantle the production lines of death. The path forward requires organization, clarity, and above all, a conscious political break with all factions of the capitalist class, whether openly reactionary like Meloni, or dressed in the pseudo-left rhetoric of the trade union officials. It requires a turn to the international working class, uniting the struggles of dockers in Genoa, Piraeus, Marseille, and beyond with those of transport manufacturing and service workers across Europe, the Middle East, and the world. Such a movement, which the IWA-RFC is building, must be connected to the fight for socialism, the only program capable of ending the system that breeds war, exploitation, and repression. For these articles and more, visit the World Socialist website at www.org. For the World Socialist website, this has been Jesse Thomas.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.